morning. On behalf of the court, I want to welcome Mishicot High School students. Would they please stand? Good morning to you, and thank you for coming, and won't you be seated, please? These high school students are in the courtroom with our Court with Class program. This is a program that has been sponsored and carried out by the Supreme Court and the State Bar for the past 2 years. It's a national prize-winning program. And the students have received summaries of the case they're about to hear and may have discussed it in their classes, and we welcome them. There are summaries of the case on the desks outside, and at noon, the students will meet with Justice Babbage. And some of your classmates from Mishicot and also the Colby High School talk about the procedures and process of this court. I would like to introduce the court to you all now that you've been introduced to us. And on my far right is Justice Pat Crooks. And to his left, Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right, Justice Donald Steinmetz. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my left, Justice William Babbage. And to his left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. With the introductions made, we will now call the first case, 97-0622J, in the matter of judicial disciplinary proceedings against the Honorable Douglas R. Stern, Municipal Judge. Representing Judge Stern is Philip Ramphin. Mr. Ramphin, you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Justices. We're here today because the Judicial Commission is asking this court to find Judge Stern in willful violation of a Supreme Court rule, and they ask that sanctions be imposed against him. It is our position that we presented up to this point that any decision on whether or not there was a willful violation in these sanctions should take into account the context in which Judge Stern acted even before he became a municipal court judge, and the actions that he took since then, and the cooperation that he showed to the Judicial Commission, and his final decision to cooperate with the Judicial Commission and to accept their decision that he had violated the Supreme Court rule. We had spent a considerable amount of time in our briefing regarding the interplay between the constitutional and the statutory language, and then the language of that of the Supreme Court rule. The purpose of that is to show that we believe we had a legitimate challenge to the application of that rule to Judge Stern, and to show that we still believe that there's a conflict, that in the event that this rule still remains on the books and is going to be applied to municipal court judges, that this court should take into account the fact that there is a specific statutory and constitutional language which would indicate that the rule should only apply to courts of record. What's most important here today, though, is if we're talking about whether or not a violation occurred, was there a willful violation of it? Judge Stern has already agreed with the Judicial Commission that he was in violation of the rule, and he resigned his position as a school board member. The initial question, I believe, must be, at what point can it be deemed that Judge Stern was in willful violation of this rule? As we've indicated in our brief, we believe that the essence of it is that when he got the decision, when he got the answer that we have been searching for almost 10 months, it was at that point that he knew this rule applied to him, and at that point, any violation after that would be willful. We have provided the court with a timeline indicating what proactive steps Judge Stern took before he became elected to both positions. He had obtained permission from the State Elections Board to run both positions. He had sent a letter to Justice former Justice Geske, regarding whether or not this rule applied to him. Received a response from her, asked for an attorney general opinion, and there were several letters back and forth regarding that. Again, although the attorney general said, well, it looks like it might apply, we can't give you an opinion in this circumstance. Of additional importance in this matter is that the attorney general said, well, we don't know if the language of the Constitution or the statute would trump or overcome the Supreme Court rule itself. We then at
Counsel, let me interrupt and ask you on the issue of willful. Don't you think the decision that this court rendered a number of years ago in regard to Judge Presentine up in Brown County was significant? Wasn't that precedent that Judge Stern was well aware of? Doesn't that go directly to the issue of willfulness?
I believe the Presentine case stands primarily for the proposition that the Supreme Court rules can apply to municipal court judges. It does set a standard that in the absence of coercion or duress, then any action that was done of their own free will is willfulness.
Wasn't it basically the same kind of situation? Judge Presentine was a municipal judge, and he decided he'd go ahead and run for county supervisor for the county board in Brown County. He did so, and this court said clearly a violation of 6004. You're going to be disciplined, and the discipline is 6 months suspension. Now, that precedent is published. It's available and was available to Judge Stern. How do you get around that?
We believe that there are certain important distinctions between the precedent, factual circumstance, and Judge Stern's. The first being that Judge Presentine was a sitting judge for over 17 years, charged with the knowledge, whether actual or constructive, that he knew of this rule. Secondly, we believe that Judge Presentine was afforded an opportunity to discuss this matter with the Judicial Commission or the body in place at that point to determine whether or not this rule applied to him and to present his case. He basically did not follow what the Judicial Commission said at that point and ignored what the commission said, and I believe ignored what the panel said, and just said this rule doesn't apply.
Well, Judge Stern doesn't claim that he didn't have knowledge of this rule. He was well aware of the rule from the correspondence. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
He just didn't think it was applicable.
We believe that we had a legitimate concern over whether or not it applied to him, and we attempted, and by the timeline we're trying to show how we attempted to get a decision, and we wanted to present our concerns to somebody that would give us a decision in this matter. I would also point out in the Presentine manner that what happened is he basically ran for both positions and ended up losing, and that is when the sanctions were applied. Finally,
now speaking about losing, is Judge Stern still a judge?
Yes, Your Honor.
He's still a municipal court judge.
And in fact, he's been reelected to the same position a year ago this spring.
Okay, so that whatever punishment, whatever discipline is meted out is significant to him as a judge.
Absolutely, Your Honor. By the timeline that we provided, we're looking back almost 3 years now, 2.5 years now, as to what occurred back then. I would also point out in the Presentine case that the actual Supreme Court rule that he was found to have been in violation of is still on the books and is still in the same form as it was then. The rule that Judge Stern has been determined to have been in violation of is my understanding, is in committee and is being studied as to whether or not this particular rule should come back on the books in the same form, in a different language form. We have submitted a comment to the committee.
Is it on the books now?
The current Supreme Court rules that we have does not have 60.04 or a similar
version. So if he did it now, he may not be in violation of anything. Is that right?
May or may not. In the preamble to the new Supreme Court rules, they say we're studying some other ones, and they still might apply, but in the most recent form that we got, of the public Supreme Court rules, the one that Judge Preston was found in violation of, is on the books. The one that Judge Stern was found in violation of is not. And this kind of dovetails into our position that we are not disputing the fact that the Supreme Court has the right to make rules to govern the judiciary. It's just that if they're going to, the constitutional language, the statutory language should be taken into account, as well as the underlying public policy that forms the basis for why you don't want a judge to hold two elected positions at the same time. Apparently, the court is satisfied that a sitting judge should not run for another office, and that's improper. But I don't see anywhere where the current rules have the same rule that Judge Stern was found in violation of.
Mr. Rampton, what was the first date at which Judge Stern learned that there was a potential violation of the rule?
The first date, we don't have the exact date. There were some phone calls and some discussions in December of 1995 or January of 1996, and it was at that point that we started to try to figure out whether or not this applied to him, and that's when it all started.
The real thrust of my question is, did he learn of the rule before the date for filing nomination papers was closed, or after?
I believe it was before he filed, or just slightly after the date of filing the nomination papers. And when he did so, he told the state elections board, I'm going to file for both. They said, we don't see any problem here.
I don't understand your answer. Either he learned about it before the filing deadline or after the filing deadline.
I believe the actual date is after he had filed both of them, and then there was...
Could he have withdrawn as a candidate after the filing deadline?
I suppose he could have withdrawn as a candidate, but what would have been the purpose of that? He was not assured of either election. And as we have indicated in our briefings, these are both matters of public service. He had been a school board member for 6 years, had been the president of the school board for 3 years, and decided to run for the Western District of Municipal Court of Waukesha County. So I mean, yes, he could have not ran for either. He could have just not run for both, or he could have chosen it.
So his name would not have been, I'm just interested whether he could have withdrawn after the filing. You're saying that he could not have withdrawn.
I believe he could have withdrawn. I'm not sure of the ins and outs of whether or not he'd still be on the ballot because he had filed.
That was my question. Okay.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I have to be honest, I don't know that answer to that.
What's the date of the letter that he wrote to Justice Geske in January?
January 25th of 1996, Your Honor. It's the second matter on our timeline.
And what's the date that he got the call from a circuit court judge in Waukesha?
We're not really sure. It was an informal discussion with Judge Foster, and she said, I think there's this rule out there. It may apply. There was no definitive answer as to that, but look at it, Doug.
Now, 6004 doesn't say he can't run for two offices, does it?
No. If he'd been a sitting judge, it would have been in violation of the same rule that Preston was.
But we're talking about 60.04, and it just says you can't hold the office. So he could have run for two offices. Then when he won two, maybe he would have had to choose one of them, which he ultimately did.
Absolutely.
Right? But he didn't have to take himself off the ballot under this rule.
I don't believe so. There's no prohibition. I don't think the Judicial Commission ever raised the fact that he shouldn't have run for both positions. I do not believe there's a Supreme Court rule that he'd be in violation of running for both.
There would have been no violation if he had lost one of the races. Is that right?
Absolutely not. Then under the 60.04, he would have held just one elected position of public trust, which 60.04 refers to.
So he got in trouble because he was too successful.
I believe so, Your Honor. What happened then, though, is that during this time period of running for them, there was a period of time that we requested an opinion from the Attorney General, and then we received a notice from the Judicial Commission shortly after the election indicating We've not made a decision. We're doing an investigation. And it was at that point, within a day or two, we wrote a letter back saying, don't do an investigation. I won both positions. Here's what we've done up to now with the Attorney General. Here's what we've done with the Ethics Board. Here's what we've done with the Supreme Court. Give us an answer. Does this apply to me? He then took the office on May 1st of 1996. Not hearing anything from the Judicial Commission, we contacted the State Wisconsin Ethics Board. They said they can't give us a response. We then filed a writ of mandamus with this court, asking that this court address the constitutional and statutory interplay with the Supreme Court rule, asking whether or not it applied to us, and if so, give us some guidance here. Again, asking for an answer in some way, does this apply? On June 11th of 1996, the Supreme Court denied it ex parte.
Was there any explanation for our denial?
No, it was just ex parte denial, just pure denial. And that was on June 11th, 1996. Now, again, we still hadn't heard from the Judicial Commission. So, yes, Judge Stern, at that point, was still holding both positions. And we're not denying that. He was acting as a school board member and as president of the school board. And he was acting, at least from May 1st of 1996 on, as a municipal court judge. Then on June 12th, almost 2.5 months after we said, yeah, we hold both positions, the Judicial Commission sent us a formal notice finding, determining that they had found cause to proceed further on these allegations and set a hearing for August. And at the first time they mentioned that there was going to be a potential willful violation. In between that time, although the rules of the Judicial Commission allowed for informal proceedings to have occurred, such as phone calls, such as opinion letters, perhaps, based on the investigation, or actually no investigation, because we had said, yeah, here the circumstances are, we didn't receive any advice or any guidance from them, no decision saying, hey, this rule applies to you, traditionally it applies to you, you know, look at precedent, you're in violation. We didn't receive anything of that. The next thing was June 12th when we ended up finding that there's a hearing going to be set. Now perhaps, and I don't want to
July 12th.
July 12th, I'm sorry. I think one of the differences between this case and Preston is that as of May 1st or May 2nd, when we received a notice of the Judicial Commission investigation, Judge Stern was a judge for maybe a week. At that point, we were searching for an answer to our question. Of course, we thought that we had a good faith argument about the interpretation, but we wanted an answer. We thought that by having the hearing that this process put into place would provide us with an opportunity and a forum to address both the question of willfulness and the question of whether or not this rule should apply to him. The hearing was supposed to be held on August 22nd, but it was adjourned for no quorum. And then the hearing was finally held on October 24th, some 3.5 months after he took office. At that hearing, and one of the stipulation of facts is the transcript of that hearing, the main thrust of the questions dealt with a conflict of interest between school board and municipal court, the amount of compensation that he received. There was one series of questions about whether or not you knew about this rule, and Judge Stern says, yeah, I knew about it, but does it apply to us? There was really no questions that I can glean from this transcript of the Judicial Commission where they addressed the question of willfulness. Were you under any pressure? Was there any competing things that you had to deal with which would cause you not to resign one of these positions upon being elected to both? Then we received the decision, which the decision is just a couple lines saying the commission has found that you were in willful violation and they've authorized a...
What date is the decision?
The decision, well, it's dated September 11th, but we received it after the hearing of October 24th of 1996, along with, in that decision, it does refer to the hearing of October 24th of 1996.
But after the hearing, it must have been a decision.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not hear
what
that.
What about after the hearing?
We received it like approximately 3 or 4 days after the hearing. 5 days after the hearing, approximately, Your Honor.
So you got a letter dated finding a violation before the hearing?
It was explained that this was some type of typographical error.
Okay.
In the Judicial Commission.
So you received it after the October 24th hearing. Did you receive it before the resignation on 10/31 or 11/13?
Yes, Your Honor. What happened is we received it. Judge Stern and I discussed it, and he said we got the answer. He informed by telephone Mr. Alexander on 10/31/96 that he will resign from the school board. Mr. Alexander indicated he passed on that information to the Judicial Commission. Then, because the school board itself has its own processes that you can't just leave them in the lurch, he had to inform them of his resignation at the November meeting, and there's a provision that they then provided for people to replace him by the time of the December meeting. So I guess the actual resignation took effect in December, but as of October 31st, Judge Stern was in compliance, or indicated he'd be in compliance with the decision of the Judicial Commission.
Did he participate in any proceedings with the school board after 10/31?
Only in a minimal manner, Your Honor. It was from that point on that they just went forward and he placed it and said, I'm going to resign at the next meeting, did not participate. I don't even think he interviewed any of the potential candidates. And then it actually took effect in December.
Counsel, why didn't he contact the Judicial Commission early on?
Perhaps, I think it was partly because we're quite potentially unaware of the Judicial Commission's role in what could be done.
Now, this may not have happened, but I note in the Presentine case, the facts as developed there were that he got a letter from the Presentine got a letter from the Office of Municipal Judge Education, and the letter said you can't hold two offices, and he called and said, well, he didn't think the rules applied to him, and then he was told that he should contact the Executive Director of the Judicial Commission. Those are the facts in Presentine. Are those the same facts in your case?
No, Your Honor. Between the time that we received a letter from the Judicial Commission indicating we've not made a decision...
Okay, I'm talking about the Office of Judicial Education.
No. We did not have any communication from them in any way, Your Honor.
Oh, I read the facts that you did, your facts, that you did have some telephone contact with the Office of Judicial Education.
Okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood the question, Your Honor. What happened is somebody named Ronnie from there, much like the same conversation with Judge Foster, said, there's the rule out there. Look at it.
Were you advised at that time that, as was true in the facts in the Presentine case, that the Office of Judicial Education advised that if you didn't think the rules applied to you, that you should contact the Executive Director of the Judicial Commission?
No, we did not receive any communication from that body to contact the Judicial Commission. And in fact, is that a question, yes?
Over the telephone conversation with Ronnie of the Office of Judicial Education, was he advised to contact the Executive Director of the Judicial Commission?
No. The first contact that we had with the Judicial Commission was their investigation letter.
And likewise, Judge Foster didn't advise to contact the Judicial Commission.
Not that I'm aware of. Now, what we thought was once the Judicial Commission started the ball rolling, that this would be our forum to get an answer.
I note that the March 27th letter from the Assistant Attorney General says, advises that in that person's opinion, that the Supreme Court Rule 60.04 seems to be quite clear and applies.
Yes, in response to that letter, and I think our original letter to the Attorney General asking for an opinion, we did not lay out our statutory and constitutional argument, so that the initial letter of the Attorney General was just in response, what does this say, taken out of context of everything else. We followed up with the letter, and then it was the response on April 14th, where the Attorney General says, I can't give you an opinion. It may be that the Supreme Court rule will be, I think is the word, trumped by the statutory and the constitutional language, but I can't tell you one way or another.
Didn't he say in the second paragraph, I also disagree with your conclusion that the statutes would trump the Supreme Court rules? He disagreed with your position as I read that letter. In a case of conflict between the statutes and the rules, the matter will be decided by analyzing the issue under the doctrine of separation of powers. But apparently he disagreed with your interpretation but couldn't give you the final opinion. Is that correct?
I believe the Attorney General did disagree with our interpretation at that point.
Counsel, it's clear from your narrative here that very early on, Judge Stern knew there was a serious question.
Absolutely.
And yet the serious question was that he might be in violation of the Judicial Code of Ethics.
If he won both elections.
Right, but he knew that if
correct.
So that was a real problem. Yet he chose to take a fairly risky course, knowing that if he was wrong, he'd be in violation of the Judicial Code of Ethics and could be subject to discipline. Now, why did he choose such a risky course?
Your Honor, I think it comes down to the fact that both these positions are public service. Both of them are based in the local community. His duties as a long-term school board member and as a president of that is to provide services for the students and community education. He felt that by giving up that duty and responsibility, he'd be violating that portion of his public trust. And he would never get an answer as to whether or not the Constitution and statute would allow him to handle both positions. Sometimes people end up resigning positions in order to provide greater public service. Sometimes, as in Judge Stern's case, they end up holding two positions and standing up and saying, here's where we're coming from. Give us an answer. I want to emphasize that at no point did Judge Stern say, hey, look, I don't care if this doesn't apply to me. I'm going to do everything I can to make it not apply. He wanted an answer. When he got an answer, he resigned. Yes, it was somewhat of a chance to take, but if he had not held both positions, I'm not sure how that question would have ever been resolved.
Counsel, in that same vein, it appears to be true that in his capacity as a judge, municipal judge, that he presided over between 10 and 20 ordinance violations that, as I understand it, arose from loitering on the school grounds, which came from the same school district in which he served as president of the school board. And I mean, I think what Justice Babich is raising, that this is the, you know, that there obviously would be a potential conflict, you know, between serving in both capacities.
Any time there's a municipal court judgeship, which is part-time, it involves a person in the community who has contacts within the community.
Sure.
There are conflicts of interest at all times. At each and every one of these times, he made the parties known that he was on the school board. He felt that at no time was there a real conflict. Had anybody suggested that there was any conflict, he could recuse himself, much like if he had an ordinance violation for his neighbor, he'd say, hey, this is my neighbor. I can't recuse myself. It happens so often in the level of municipal court judge at a part-time. It could be that Judge Stern, in his practice of law, would have had come into contact with some other people. I don't think the school board position brought him into a position where anybody would feel that he was putting the integrity of the judicial system into question.
Thank you, Mr. Rampagno. We'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Alexander, James Alexander, representing the Wisconsin Judicial Commission. Mr. Alexander.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court. I am James Alexander, representing the Wisconsin Judicial Commission. The commission feels this is a very straightforward case. This is a case of a municipal court judge who was aware of the Code of Judicial Ethics and a provision that applied to his conduct and violated it knowingly. And Commission agrees with the findings of fact and conclusions of law of the Judicial Conduct Panel, but feels that the reprimand recommended by that panel is not sufficient discipline to address the misconduct in this case. There are really only two issues, and there have never been more than two issues in this case: willfulness and discipline. On the issue of willfulness, there's never been any question that SCR 60.04, as it existed at the time of this conduct, was clear and unambiguous.
Yeah, but he thought it wasn't lawful.
Pardon me, Chief Justice?
He did not think that that was a valid rule. We've adopted some rules that have been challenged as being invalid.
There was never
Sometimes
any question.
Sometimes they are.
There's never any question in this case that this rule was invalid. There was never any question raised in this case that the did not have authority to promulgate this rule. In fact, the case of In re Katie, decided in 1975, clearly states that this court has authority to promulgate the Code of Judicial Ethics.
I know, but his theory, which I think is wrong, but his theory was that the statute really covered the entire waterfront. I know it only referred to certain judges, but that by doing that, it eliminated any others, as if it had a semicolon and said, no other provisions apply to dual offices by judges. What's the matter with that theory?
Theory is, first of all, it ignores the plain language of the statute. It ignores case law. It ignores the fact that the statute and constitutional provision eventually relied upon. Now, I want to point out to the court that this theory was not developed by Judge Stern or Judge Stern-elect until well into March of 1996, between the time he received correspondence from Assistant Attorney General Alan Lee and Alan Lee's follow-up letter.
Well, what about his March 12th letter when he requested an attorney general opinion? What was his theory in that one?
Prior to March 12th, including his letter to Justice Geske, he is railing against the unfairness of the rule and why it should not apply to municipal court judges. He did not say at that point that the rule was vague. He did not say that the rule would not apply to him. He was saying the problem is it does, and it will preclude me from serving in both positions. It wasn't until his second letter to the Attorney General's office that he says, my research indicates this statute and this constitutional provision. Therefore, I think I can do what I have wanted to do all along. Now, the statute and the constitutional provision on their face are not in conflict with SCR 60.04. They're different in application only, and there is no authority saying that this court could not promulgate SCR 60.04 and make it applicable to municipal court judges despite the language of the statute and of the constitutional provision. And I think that's clear, and I have a difficult time understanding how Judge Stern could conjure vagueness out of those two provisions, which would allow him to persistently and notoriously engage in misconduct in the months that he did.
Now, when did this misconduct start?
When he was sworn in as a municipal court judge.
So not until 5-1. He could have run for both offices. You're not claiming otherwise.
That is correct.
Okay.
Mr. Alexander, where does it say that 60.04 applies to municipal judges?
SCR 60.39, then in existence, was the applicability statute in the Code of Judicial Ethics. And sub 2 indicates those provisions of that Code of Judicial Ethics that do not apply to part-time municipal court judges. 60.04 is not listed as one of those provisions that does not apply
but
to municipal
judge. The term judge is not defined to include municipal judges. Isn't that correct?
The term judge is defined in Section 757.81 of the statutes, giving the Judicial Commission authority over municipal court judges. It's also mentioned in Article 7, Section 3 of the Wisconsin Constitution. Municipal court judges are judges under Wisconsin's unified court system.
Could I ask a couple of last questions here? Where is the definition for Office of Public Trust?
There is no definition of office of public trust. That issue has never been raised. Judge Stern has always admitted that serving as an elected school board member was an office of public trust, and the panel so found.
Well, let me ask this. If Mr. Stern had been a teacher, could he have served as a municipal judge?
In my opinion? Are you asking for my opinion, Justice Breyer?
Well, I mean, is that an office of public trust?
As far as I'm concerned, no.
If Mr. Stern had been a principal, could
he? In my opinion, no.
No?
That is correct.
What about the Board of Regents?
Yes.
What's the difference?
The difference is that a Board of Regents is an appointed position to make policy decisions for example, the University of Wisconsin system. They're appointed by the governor with the approval of the Senate, and I believe they take an oath of office. A principal or a school teacher are appointed professionals that run the day-to-day operations of school, do the very important job of teaching and bringing kids to courtrooms and whatnot like that to learn, but they are not, in my opinion, the type of official that is holding an office of public trust. We're talking about elected positions, primarily. Well, perhaps a law enforcement position, a sheriff, a deputy sheriff, a police officer, those that are part of the executive branch, those that are part of the legislative branch, because I think the thrust of the rule is separation of powers.
Well, let me ask. I just want to clarify this. Are you saying that if Mr. Stern had been a teacher or a principal, or a school administrator, all because they had not been elected, he would have been able to be a municipal judge?
I would say he would not be in violation of SCR 60.04. If there was others, some conflict of interest provision that would have raised, that is another question. I did not say school administrator. If you're including in school administrator, an elected school board member, a president of a school board, I would disagree with you.
But
if you're
a school administrator, the superintendent of schools, not elected.
Well, superintendent of public instruction, for example, is an elected position.
Yeah, but superintendent of schools is not elected.
I'm not sure whether it is or isn't, so
well,
I can't answer
that. Well, it's not, and it's an office that is the head administrative office of a district, like the school superintendent of Madison or whatever district you're talking about. Listen,
could I ask this? If you have a full-time court commissioner, could a full-time court commissioner under the rule have served as a municipal judge?
SCR 60.04 says you shall not serve in another office of public trust beside a judicial office. I think a full-time court commissioner office could be considered another judicial office.
Well, now what about 60.07, which defines position of trust? A judge shall not accept any duties or continue to administer or hold any fiduciary position or position of trust or incur any obligations, and then it says, which are or will be inconsistent with the expeditious, impartial, and proper administration of the duties of his or her office, or which will involve association with enterprises or persons which are likely to become before the judge. Okay. That limits public position of trust.
I'm sorry, Chief Justice, I missed where you were.
I'm saying 6007 talks about a position of trust. Now, 6004 talks about an office of public trust. Are they different?
Yes. A position of trust in 6007, I think, would include those positions. For example, it talks about fiduciary positions, trustees, and whatnot. 60.04 goes more to the publicly elected public service type of position. Your legislators, members of the executive branch, members of quasi-legislative or quasi-executive commissions that are appointed with approval of the legislature, etc. 60.07, in my view, goes more to private enterprise aspect, the off-the-bench private enterprise aspect of judges.
Could a court commissioner have served as a school board member?
Elect a school board member? No.
Where does it say that?
Well, I got to go back and look. SCR 60.39 sub 3 deals with court commissioners.
And it doesn't reference 60.04.
That's correct. So I stand corrected. Part-time court commissioner, full-time court commissioner.
I'm really struggling with the sense of the rule here. If a full-time judicial court commissioner can serve as a school board member, and if a school principal or school administrator or teacher can serve as a municipal judge, I mean, how does the rule make any sense?
Well, first of all, it's a separation of powers rule. I'm not saying that a full-time court commissioner could serve as an elected school board representative. What I'm saying is that SCR 60.04 would not apply. There could be a myriad of other code provisions that would include conflict of interest, administering the law free of partiality or the appearance of partiality. It's not a given that a full-time court commissioner could serve as an elected school board member. I'm just saying 60.04 would not apply. But that's not the case we have here. Clearly it applied to Judge Stern.
No problem with Judge Stern practicing law under the rules. Is that right?
That is correct.
That has all sorts of potential conflicts of interest.
It has all sorts of potential conflicts of interest. Those conflicts of interest are addressed in other provisions of the code, and those municipal court judges that practice law have to be very careful as to practice law and to perform their duties as municipal court judges so that they do not come into conflict.
Mr. Alexander, let me put this in a little bit different context so I can explore your thinking and the thinking of the Judicial Commission. Let's assume that I, as a judge, receive a gift from my uncle, who was also a lawyer. And I received this back in 1966, so I didn't have the advantage of Judge Barlin's committee to talk to. And I was perplexed as to whether I could keep that gift or not, because although it's from a family member, it's done in the normal course. On the other hand, he's a lawyer, so I've got a real problem with this. And I keep the gift, and I begin taking steps. I don't call you. I forget to call you or whatever. I don't know that I can call you and get some friendly advice. So I talk to the Attorney General, and he doesn't give me any help at all. And I talk to others, and I'm warned by people that this could be a problem. And meanwhile, I got the gift sitting at home. Maybe it's a set of golf clubs or something like that. What if it finally comes to your attention that I got this gift and I'm trying to find out what to do with it, what would you do?
If it came to my attention that you had this gift and you were in a quandary as to what to do with it?
Yeah.
I would call you and discuss it with you.
Now, tell me where that example of mine is different from this. I mean, at least from the interpretation of Judge Stern, he had this office. And he didn't know whether he could hold it or not. And he talked to the Attorney General, and some people told him he could hold it, and some people said he couldn't. And he never got a definitive ruling. And unfortunately, and then when it came to your attention, as I understand it, the Judicial Commission notice finding cause to proceed on allegations and setting, I guess that was on July 12th of 96. How is my example much different from what Judge Stern is arguing before us today, that he, in essence, was in this quandary, didn't know what to do, looked around for a solution, and once he finally got a final resolution, he resigned?
Judge Stern's case is far different from your hypothetical.
Okay, why?
One, no one ever told Judge Stern that he could hold both positions. No one. Every time he got advice, they said you couldn't. Two, Judge Stern never found the Judicial Commission. He found the Board of Ethics. He found the Elections Board. He found the Attorney General's office, seemingly without any problem. He never found the Judicial Commission, one agency called upon to interpret and enforce the very code that he was looking at. He never found the roadmap case of In Re Crescent, 1989 case. When he was contacted by the Judicial Commission, it was to say that an investigation had been authorized. His response was not to seek an answer from the Judicial Commission. His response was to say, I think I can do this, and I'm going to file a writ, he called it a writ of mandamus, a writ of prohibition, with the Supreme Court, asking them to stop what he termed in that writ an unjust investigation. So his response wasn't, tell me what I should do because I'm in a quandary. His response was, I think I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, and he did it. And the only time he stopped doing it was when we told him we were going to file a formal complaint in the Supreme Court. And I think there's a big difference between that conduct and the hypothetical that you raised to me, Justice Babbage. Uh-huh. If we would have been asked, we would have given him informal guidance. If when we started our investigation, he would have said, I'm in a quandary, I would have given him my opinions. What we got was a letter said, I think I can do it, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to make an end run around your procedures and attempt to stop, again, what he termed our unjust investigation. So those are the differences.
You think somebody has, under the law, the power to make an end run?
No.
Why not?
Because I do not think that this court, with all due respect to this court, has the power to come in and stop the investigation of an independent agency like the Judicial Commission. This issue was raised in the state of Nevada when the Supreme Court tried to come in and stop a commission investigation, saying you cannot investigate until you have probable cause that a judge has engaged in misconduct. And even the Supreme Court in the state of Nevada had to say that that can't be, because how can you find probable cause if you can't investigate? I think there, under certain circumstances, if this court finds that the Judicial Commission is acting so far outside the scope of its jurisdiction and authority, it could come in and say that the Judicial Commission is acting illegally. Yes. Yes, that would be an issue. But to come in and stop an investigation, stop our procedures, no, I don't think so. That's my personal opinion.
Mr. Alexander, will you explain to us why you feel that the recommendation for a public reprimand is not sufficient and why there should be a suspension here?
The misconduct in this case is serious. Misconduct in this case is very similar to that in In Re Precedent. And In Re Precedent says in that case, this misconduct is serious. The public expects judges to obey the law. A judge who cannot be expected to require others to obey the law. Precedent provided the roadmap. Do not violate the law. There are ways that you can get your answer without putting yourself at risk. The integrity of the judicial system requires that judges obey the code of judicial ethics.
I agree with you, and I also think that it's important that sentencing be consistent. And at the one hand, you have to take into account each case on its merits, and on the other hand, you want to have a consistency. So how does that 15 days fit in with other areas or other judges who've had problems? And what comes to my mind is the Dreyfus case, where it was a 15-day suspension. Presentine was 6 months. Where does it fit into the range? Who else got a... And Tesmer got a public reprimand. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. So where does this fit into the range of... Of those cases.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, sir.
The closest case that we have to this scenario, and it's remarkably close, is In Re Precedent. I think it was a 60-day suspension, although...
How many months?
I think it was 60 days, but I would have to go back. When you said 6 months, I thought maybe my impression of the 60-day was wrong. The closest case, in any event, that we have is In Re Precedent, and it's a 60-day suspension. The facts and the law in this case, in that case, are remarkably similar.
Counsel, I think it is 6 months. I have the opinion.
Okay, I apologize.
6 months. So you're only asking for 15 days.
15
days. How does that compare with Tesmer? How does it compare with Dreyfus?
It compares to Tesmer, as far as the Judicial Commission is concerned, with all due respect to this court. In the Tesmer case, the Judicial Commission felt that a suspension of 6 months was minimal. And we advocated that to this court. This court felt that a public reprimand was appropriate. And we take that into consideration. We thought that Judge Tesmer's misconduct was serious. We thought that Judge Dreyfus's misconduct was serious, and there was a 15-day suspension. Judge Dreyfus's misconduct involved delay two cases and the failure to file proper certificates of status in pending cases.
Misstated certificates.
Pardon me?
Misstated certificates.
Misstated certificates and lied to the commission investigator. 15-day suspension. This case is of a different type, but its effect upon the integrity of the judicial system is significant. And that's what Crescenton said. Why? Because you have a judge that ignored the advice from several respected corners, ignored decided case law, ignored a plain statute, and took this risk, saying, I am going to continue to violate this law until I am told to stop. What does that tell the people that come before Judge Stern? How can he be expected to enforce the law? Judge, I don't think that stop sign should be there. I don't think I should have to stop, so I'm going to continue to go through it until you tell me to stop. And then, because I disagree that that stop sign should be there, you shouldn't do anything to me because I have a legitimate reason in my own mind not to stop. Is a judge supposed to say, okay, stop from now on, but I'm not going to give you any judgment or
Mr. Alexander, if this had occurred in May of 1997, what would you have done then?
What would the Judicial Commission have done in May of 1997?
Yeah.
Well, there was a different code, what's now called the Code of Judicial Conduct, in effect. We probably would have brought this case, but under different code provisions.
There is a parallel provision of law right now?
There is no identical code provision now. The code provision now that is closest, I think, is 60.05(3). It says judges may not accept appointments to government commissions or committees, but it does not apply to part-time municipal court judges. We would have probably brought this case under a more general heading, either 60.01 or 60.03(1), involving the independence and integrity of the judicial system, or the more specific 60.05(1)(a)(c) regarding avoiding outside interests that compromise the impartiality of the judiciary or interfere with the proper performance of judicial duties. And I say that because although Judge Stern is not charged with that here, he was presiding over ordinance violation cases that occurred on school premises over which he had authority as a school board member. So there was an apparent conflict in the positions. And once again, it's a separation of powers issue. And the rule in 60.04 is just like 60.05, prophylactic. And it should be noted that under the present code, Judge Stern would have had to resign his judgeship in order to run for re-election to the school board, because the resign to run code provision remains in effect, and that's 60.06(1). So he may have been able to hold this position, all things considered, but he would have had to resign in order to run for re-election to the school board. That would have been similar to the present situation.
Mr. Alexander, short of going, this goes along the question, along the line of what should he have done. Short of him calling you and asking for informal advice, what could he have done? And I ask that question in the context of Crescenton, in which that exact issue was raised by Judge Crescenton when he said that he was testing the validity of the law. And in answer to that, we said, if that was his intention, he could have and should have commenced an action for an injunction against enforcement of the rule or for declaratory judgment that the rule was invalid or did not apply to him, rather than violate the rule. Is that what he should have done here?
Yes, sir.
And you don't consider that petition for mandamus to this court anything close to that?
No, sir, because at that time he was already in violation of the rule, and he had no intention of being otherwise.
And if he had applied for an injunction to this court, I thought your answer about 10 or 15 minutes ago was that we couldn't enjoin you.
From stopping our procedures, I think that's true, but you could have issued a declaratory judgment and enjoined us from filing a complaint with the Supreme Court based upon the declaratory judgment action that is prescribed in present.
If
I didn't mean to indicate that we would object to the procedures that were outlined in present, and that's not true. That was the way he should have proceeded.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, what we're saying is, and I think it's eminently clear, he should not have been sworn in as a judge. And that...
Or as a school board member. He had to take a choice.
He had to make a choice on May 1st what he was going to do, and he made his choice to continue and put himself at risk. Now, fortunately, today we have the advisory opinion system, but it's not conclusive. Judge Stern could have gotten an advisory opinion and ignored it. He certainly got enough other informal opinions that he seemed to ignore. But let me say this.
So indeed, there's an opinion by a justice of this court that would indicate that the judges don't have to get advice from anybody, and that it's demeaning for them to get advice because they can read the law.
Well, I think judges do need advice, Chief Justice.
But you know the opinion to which I'm referring.
I think that one of the interesting things about the formal advisory opinion system is that it only allows judges to request formal advisory opinions for contemplated conduct. It does not allow for judges who are already engaging in conduct to seek advice on whether they should continue or not. So it has adopted this in re precedentem theory as get the advice first. Don't violate the law. And again, we're not dealing with a vague or unintelligible code provision. It's clear, as the panel found, it's unambiguous and it clearly applied to municipal court judges. I think that one of the key things on the issue of discipline is deterrence. So many judges have ethical questions and believe firmly, for example, I should be able to raise money for this charity and I can't, and they forego doing it. To allow somebody in such a clear circumstance to continue to do something until they have formal charges filed against them denigrates all those judges who, in good faith, try to abide by the code. And we cannot give the judges or the public the message that judges can continually violate the code until they're told to stop doing so by the Judicial Commission, because that isn't the way judges operate, of course.
Mr. Alexander, if there were no code and you were arguing for exactly what you believe 6004 used to say, give me the guts of why it is just wrong for a judge, a municipal judge, to hold a school board position.
Separation of powers. Separation of powers is clear as a bell. We have three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. It compromises the independence of the judicial branch of government to have members of the judiciary also be members of the legislature and of the executive branch. Can you imagine an elected village board member also serving as a municipal court judge?
As a part-time municipal court judge?
As a part-time municipal court judge.
Well,
part-time municipal court judges are members of Wisconsin's unified court system.
But this part-time municipal judge could have been appointed to a village commission that was going to study how to make better village ordinances, because that would have been authorized under the administration of justice. I just had that one out under the new code. Judges can serve on executive commissions appointed by the governor, and we have several, including in the criminal law field.
Yeah, there's an exception. I'm sorry.
There is an exception, and the exception is that you can for the administration of justice, broadly stated. So there isn't a total separation of powers doctrine for judges, not even for judges of this court.
in matters of the law, the legal system, and the administration of justice, that is the exception.
Mr. Alexander, I could accept what you have said if it were clear, if it were not clear that a court commissioner, under these rules could also serve as a school board member. I mean, if you'd had nice, consistent rules, and if there was some way to say to me, you know, the principal of a school or a school superintendent cannot serve, but they can serve. It's absolutely clear you have someone in an executive branch position and you have someone in a judicial position. And there's no problem there, apparently. And yet the potential conflict is, I think, far more serious.
What was your question, Justice Cross?
Well, how do we reconcile this?
Second of all, we're not here hammering out what the rule is. The rule was what the law was. The law was it was at that time. Whether it makes any sense to us or not, I'm not prepared to argue. I think it makes eminent sense on separation of powers grounds, and I think that an elected school board representative is put there to make.